Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
How you doing, internet? It is a day of the week, and we haven't decided which day it is yet, and that's okay.
It's because we're drunk. Listening.
It's 2017. Everything's upside down. I don't know what's going on. But hey, you're listening to Waypoint Radio. That's very exciting. I'm Danielle Riendo. I'm going to be your host today. Austin is doing a thing, an important thing. Again, depending on what day this actually goes up, it's going to be a different thing. So, joining me are Patrick Klepek.
I'm drunk!
Patrick Drunk Klepek. What are you drunk on?
I'm drunk on this coffee.
Oh, good. Good. That's a good thing to be drunk on. And also, probably not drunk on coffee yet, but maybe getting
probably
there is Rob
Zachney. Probably something else, actually, if you want to do a timeline of this show.
Yeah, considering. Well, we've got Rob Zachney with us, too. How you doing, Rob?
Wait, I thought this was the Mitchell Trubisky hour.
You know what?
I know who that is.
That pylon is going to... I've had nightmares about it, Rob. I've had nightmares about that pylon. Let him throw the ball. Tariq Cohen has had 8 touches in 2 games. What's going on? Darryl Loggins, whatever that Dowell Loggins, I'm not going to pronounce your name correctly because you don't deserve it. You're not a coordinator. Get out of town.
Mitch Trubisky is a football player for the Chicago Bears.
Accurate.
He's like allegedly 21, and his nickname is Mr. Biscuit.
Correct.
That's all I know about him, but I knew that.
He also has some
Mr. Biscuit.
Really interesting tweets. Just search Mitchell.
They're
Trubisky,
real good.
Mitchell Trubisky tweets. He when he was drafted,
he really got the most out of high school football.
You would think at this point that they'd be prepping these players with, you know, folks that know they're gonna go in like early rounds of the draft. Like, hey, have someone comb through your social media feed and like find. Now his tweets weren't like secretly he's a racist. They were just like dumb shit that high schoolers say, and he was a fan of the Green Bay Packers, which is very funny.
Look, by the standards of 2017,
his
tweets were adorable.
They were. 100%.
I'm glad. Anyway. I'm glad that he's living his best life. I mean, that's
well,
good.
He's on the Bears.
As much as anyone can when your head coach is John Fox.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so that felt like an hour.
That's fair.
So that I feel like that was the Mitchell Trubisky
We did
hour.
It. We did the...
Peace.
We did it. I'm so proud. Well, in honor of Mr. Biscuit, we're doing a full question bucket episode where we're going to do some old question bucket and some new question bucket. And I think in honor of Mr. Biscuit, we should... Why don't we start with his number? What's his number? Do you know?
That's a great question. I don't know his number. I mean, Jay Cutler was 6, but I don't think...
Yeah, let's do 6.
Yeah, let's do 6. Like, that's the one that actually matters.
That's exciting because that was my lacrosse number in college.
That's not exciting. It's not a man you want to be associated with. But you know.
Oh, well, I'll just read the question then.
Jay Cutler did nothing wrong. Well.
Oh, no.
Well.
All right, let's just keep moving.
Okay.
Vaccines are good, kids.
Yeah. This question comes from Naveen in Toronto. Naveen writes, your recent discussion about Red Dead Redemption Undead Nightmare...
Yep, definitely
very
a recent,
recent
discussion.
It's got me thinking about DLC as an excuse to revisit old games. With the recent trend of old PC games getting new levels and missions many years after the fact, see Quake and Duke Nukem 3D, it seems like the time is ripe for older console games to get fresh DLC that mixes classic gameplay with the lessons of modern game design. I mean, how cool would it be to get a new set of missions for Battlefield Bad Company or a standalone story set in the Bully universe? Anyway, setting aside business deals, licensing, and any other red tape, what games from the last gen would you like to see the DLC treatment, and what would that DLC be?
I always have trouble with these questions where I got to come up with something. Let me just bullshit riff and comment instead of actually having a genuinely good idea.
Okay, so one thing that's going on right now, like, some people are trying to do this right now. Like Creative Assembly, who make the Total War series, literally just came out with a new like DLC campaign for Total War Rome 2, which I think is like 3 or 4 years old at this point. Like it's pretty old at like right now, and yet they're still like coming out with pretty significant new patches and new expansions.
And it's not a game that was pitched as like games as a service, you know, like which is the really trendy thing now.
Yeah, and so I think it is interesting that I think in some ways this model is shifting. The question really comes down to, is a game popular enough that it somehow can be turned into a service retroactively, right? Like, does it have a wide enough, what we used to call, like, install base. Does it have a wide enough audience that it becomes worth it to support in that way? Apparently, Rome 2, has sort of hit that critical mass, and so they're continuing to create new content for it. I'm not sure how many games can pull that off, but it's definitely something that, you know, I enjoy the idea of. I think one thing that I'm sort of keen to dig into on, so I've been playing, like we talked about the other week, I'm playing a lot of, like, Xbox One X now.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the features they really push is that a lot of last-gen games or early this-gen games have been, like, significantly up-resed or modified to take advantage of the new hardware power, the new hardware capabilities. And one of the games they're sort of using as a showpiece, they're really promoting right now, is State of Decay. And State of Decay, I think, was a fantastic game with a lot of really sort of brilliant ideas and features in it. And now that it's sort of been modernized in some ways, I'm kind of looking at it like, yeah, I think I would get back into that. And I would definitely be into, like, there being more, you know, more characters, more story stuff, more locations added to that game just to sort of, expand that world.
Yeah. That sounds really rad. Mine would be a really blue sky thing that will never happen ever. But hey, you know, Naveen is asking us to dare to dream. So I'm going to dare to dream. I would love to have, like, new Zelda dungeons. I would love to have, like, Wind Waker, a new dungeon or something. You know, like a two-hour experience, something I could actually play in one sitting. Just go in, and it's something wildly creative. It's something completely, I don't know. I'm not going to, like, pull anything out of a hat right now. But something really kind of out there and weird and have, like, oh, a new dungeon experience comes out for $5 or whatever. I would
Zelda
be,
is Hitman now.
Yeah, exactly. Zelda Hitman. I mean, again, I don't think it's ever going to happen. Obviously, Breath of the Wild has DLC, and I'm interested in that, and I've played, you know, the DLC that's come out already for that, but I just miss Wind Waker. When we were talking about, like, oh, last gen, I was like, yeah, you know what was a great game? Wind Waker. So that's where my head is at. I like the sailing. I like that game a lot. It's a good-ass game.
Man, just give me more Bully. Come on, don't. You can't say Bully without getting me upset. Bully, the not even the secret. It's just the best Rockstar game, and it just upsets me that we didn't get more Bully. So they would just make an expansion, just take one of the cut levels that wasn't any good, and just say, "Here, assholes, here's some more Bully." I'd buy it. I'd play it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I never played it, and I know I need to.
I don't know. It's 2017. I don't know how well that world holds up. That is pretty creaky at this point, probably, but man, it was one of those worlds that when you played it, the parts of it that worked, you were just really excited to see what they could have done with another crack at it, and it always kind of bums me out they never got a chance to do that or decided not to.
Yeah, that's fair. That's very fair. All right, I'm gonna read a new question. I've got a couple of new questions, and then there's, like, the old bucket. We're getting through both. We're skimming from the top, and we're digging from the bottom.
Wait, it sort of sounds to me like you just said there's two buckets now. Are they multiplying?
Well, it's kind of like there's a meta bucket, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a multiverse, a multi-bucket. So just consider this the many worlds theory of buckets, of question
okay.
buckets. Okay. And we're doing okay. We're going to get through it. So this one just came in, and it's almost kind of more of an observation than a question, but hey, I'm going to read it anyway. Is the trend towards free-to-play games and loot boxes a reflection of the income inequality in real life? i.e. 2% of the players paying for the game, mirroring 2% of people having the most wealth.
Well, in that scenario, if we were to take that parallel, then somehow the 2%, the 1% of the wealthiest are, they're really helping us out. They're like making it so that we can exist, which doesn't feel like that's actually how the real world works. It mostly seems like they just want more and want to fuck us, as opposed to the way theoretically a lot of free-to-play games work, in which and you'll talk to free-to-play developers that work on those games, in which, you know, there was one that was a developer that worked on the Old Republic, right? That was the MMO that BioWare did, right?
Yes.
I think. Anyway,
the Old Republic, yes.
Yeah, he
yes,
worked
yes.
on some multiplayer game, some free-to-play games, and worked on Old Republic when they transitioned to free-to-play. And I don't know exactly who to point you to, but if you search that, it'll probably come up. And like in his tweet storm was like, you know, if done right, and there are gonna be some people that don't think you can do this stuff right, like that, and any form of like microtransactions and loot boxes and free to play mechanics are inherently exploitive, and that is a fair position, I think, to take. But that for a bunch of them, you know, that 2% actually is why the 98% are able to play and enjoy the game, and I think that's. But I don't think that's how real life works.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's almost as if this is a very idealized version of what that 2% thinks. That what they think of the actual world. Like, oh yes, we keep them all afloat, those parasites. I don't know.
I think they probably, those 2%, the whales in the free-to-play games, they spend their money and don't give a shit about everyone else. And that's not to say in a like, condescending way. It's that, like, this designer that was talking about the mentality of whales is often, it's people with large disposable income. The way we buy a coffee and don't think about it is the way they drop $500 on some microtransactions, because that to them, that is just relative to their own personal wealth. That is like getting a cup of coffee.
Spending money.
I want to live in that world.
Yeah, right? That sounds nice.
I want to pay $500 for a cup of coffee.
I mean, can you imagine how good that coffee is?
Oh.
Maybe I'm talking to the wrong person, though, about good coffee. I don't know.
Well, he gets drunk on it. Like,
that's
I'm
right.
not sure. There's, I'm not sure there's coffee in his coffee. To be honest, like, he's just like, you know, tipping the Kahlua like, you know, straight over and just being like, yeah, this counts.
It's
close enough.
Coffee flavored alcohol is still coffee, man.
It still counts.
Still counts.
That's fair. All right. Well, Rob, why don't you give me a number? We're gonna dig through the old bucket here. Old bucket number.
34.
34. I'm going to be 34 soon, sadly. You know, I'm just going to give you a personal anecdote about the life of Danielle with each one of these numbers, and I bet you're real excited about that. Okay, 34. Oh, we got a long one. This 34 comes from Keith.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Keith, get Hello? A copy editor.
Keith. Come on, Keith. All right, Keith writes, "Hello, Wayward Gamers. I was curious to know your feelings on the mechanic of permadeath. Not so much as in roguelikes where you start over, but in games where the game will continue on. I recently played Darkest Dungeon and thought they handled it in an expert manner. Although you can lose characters suddenly to RNGesus, that's cute. See, sorry, I editorialized there. They are easily replaceable. And crucially, you can bring up new characters with level 1 missions. So you're never really stuck, just set back. Compare that to XCOM, and I think DD does it better. XCOM has a nail-biting death mechanic, but I feel forced into save-scumming because losing a high-level character is so debilitating in the late game. You may not even realize you're screwed until a few missions later when your now-depleted force cannot hope to stand up to the constantly escalating alien menace. Fire Emblem strikes me as having a similar problem. The loss of a character is too great, causing the player to scum. Invisible Ink has a different but equally elegant solution that I also like. They give you the opportunity to save the character, either with a multitude of abilities during an Overwatch turn, or by rescuing the body and taking it with you. I thought this brilliantly put the player on the edge of their seat without obliterating their progress. When I play XCOM now, I mod it to have the soldiers bleed out instead of insta-jib and get it closer to this type of situation. Still dire, but not irretrievable. That solution makes the mission harder due to your carelessness without ruining the campaign, but I could also envision an XCOM where the character progression is much flatter and soldiers more replaceable, closer to the original 90s title. Please persist in producing positively pleasing podcasts. Your humble listener, Keith the Nomad."
Rob, you've been playing a lot of XCOM, but I feel like you probably fall on the side of admiring the hardcore elements of it. No.
Whoa. Well, so no.
M. Night
so
Shyamalan.
Here's the thing. This is an extremely extremely double-edged sword. And hardcore mechanics in particular, I think, can lend themselves to kind of destructive dynamics in the discourse around a game and the way people end up approaching it. I think XCOM sort of got, like, the whole, like, cult that grew up around Iron Man mode, I think, probably sort of skewed what was good about that game. But so the thing is, with permadeath, there's a really hard decision you got to make at the start of a game, because I'm not sure the two ideas are really compatible. You can either save and reload in the campaign at any time, or you can't ever do that, and you just have to play it as it lays. And I think where XCOM ends up running into trouble is that it sort of tries to ride both horses, as it were. And it has an Iron Man mode, and if you listen to sort of the posturing around the game, is some of which you'll find, like, you know, the designer Jake Solomon even sort of doing, right? Like, he sort of presents himself as he was Mr. Hardcore, old school XCOM. He's making hardcore, you know, old school XCOM values for the new series. But at the same time, XCOM doesn't really work unless you save and reload. From time to time, particularly on harder difficulties, because XCOM also has these pretty massive swings where, you know, character is in cover, has a very low chance of getting hit.
But then they do.
Yeah, and it's critical, and they're instantly killed.
Right.
Oh.
And that is a very tough thing to design and balance for, particularly, as Keith points out, when you've got a campaign where, like, the core dynamic is your characters generally survive, become more capable, get more effective, and can therefore fulfill harder missions.
Ideally, they're getting out injured, they're sidelined for a mission or two, but then they come back into the rotation as, like, it's, the game doesn't seem necessarily balanced for the idea that you're constantly actually losing guys, more that just, like, you're temporarily losing them, but then when you hit those moments where you actually outright lose them, it feels like an unfair swing, even if the game by necessity has to account for scenarios where you're going to actually lose characters.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think I totally get why Keith sort of has modded XCOM to have a slightly more a longer runway to having characters actually die. I think Invisible Ink probably is one of the, like, great examples of doing this, because Invisible Ink manages to, like, include all those Iron Man elements and really be demanding, but I don't think necessarily brutalizes you with as much sort of random mischance and misfortune as you encounter with XCOM. And Darkest Dungeon is just kind of a tremendous game because, like, it is so brilliantly... Okay, so the thing that Darkest Dungeon does is when a character is near death, they still have to take damage, and then every time they take additional damage while they are near death, the game basically rolls a die to see whether or not they finally kick the bucket this time. And those and the odds of that are not great. Chances are that character is going to survive being near death for quite some time. But what it does is it gives you this feeling of, like, sustained, like, grinding panic that is really pretty clever, because, like, really, the odds of any of your soldiers dying in Darkest Dungeon at any given moment are much lower than in XCOM, but it always feels way more perilous. I think there's a lot of ways to handle it. I think what doesn't work is this idea that you can sort of go in both directions at once, right? Where you can have a great permadeath system with no saves, and then you can also have a game that you can sort of conveniently save and reload at any time until you get better results.
I wish XCOM, like, built in things like rewind mechanics, not something you could infinitely use, but I would probably, so when I've beaten XCOM and XCOM 2, and I've played a bunch of Fire Emblems, I haven't played the XCOM expansion, which I know is like a more hardcore experience with a lot more variables that you're dealing with. But like, I never, like, one of the things they did between XCOM and XCOM 2 was essentially sort of like try and have it both ways, knowing that people were like, save scumming makes it sound worse than it is, right? It's really just like, in a like catastrophic scenario, you're moving back a pace to try and account for that. But one of the things they changed between XCOM and XCOM 2 is that they got rid of a specific exploit, which I actually think is so. Like, so what they did was, so let's say you're lining up a shot on, and this is like the flip scenario. You're lining up a shot on an alien, and you've got a 98% chance of hitting it, and you miss, because sometimes that happens. It's frustrating, but it is like it is part of the memification of XCOM, and it's also part of the joy of XCOM. In XCOM 1, if you were to reload a save and take that shot again, it actually re-rolled the percentage of your ability to pull that off. So there was a good chance that that 2% miss was not going to come up again, because the game was actually recalculating that shot. Whereas in XCOM 2, they lock in the value on your save. So if you are to go back and make the exact same move, the game is going to account for that, and if you do the exact same thing, you're going to get the exact same result. And so when I play XCOM 2 and say, like, would reload a save that was maybe a couple of moves back, like, it often felt like, even if you didn't know this on the surface because the game wasn't communicating this to you, I felt like I was in a fairer scenario with the game and the game designers, because what they were basically saying was like, hey, like, make a different tactical decision and see if you get a different outcome, which feels like a fair way of, like, kind of dealing with that scenario. And that's how I deal with Fire Emblem. Like, I play Fire Emblem on permadeath, but if I lose a character, I restart the round. And what that means is that it's not that I'm, like, doing this the scenario exactly the same again or going back to, like, one move ago. I have to start the whole round all over again and try and approach it differently to get a different outcome. And so it ends up making those games more like a puzzle, or adding some puzzly elements to them. And I've never felt that treating them that way has taken away from my gratification of playing them. It's certainly a hard design problem to account for sure.
I think you have a better attitude about it than I do, Patrick. I just get mad. I just get very angry. Your ability to look at it like a puzzle is the exact opposite of me looking at it like, fuck this game, I hate it, and running away screaming. So I respect that. I really respect that. Can't do it, but I respect the hell out of it.
Can't do it. Danielle, your reaction to frustration with games does seem to be actually, no, screw you, I'm going to finish you no matter what it costs me.
Yeah, that happens sometimes too, actually. Yep. Depending on the game, there might be, there might be a different type of emotional reaction. That's fair. All right, let's go to the new question bucket again. The new portion of the metaverse of the question, whatever the fuck
you
said earlier.
You tipped your hand there.
Yeah, sorry. I've got two documents open here, but they're both Waypoint Radio documents, so it's fair. All right. I got a good one. Got a good one here. Hi, gang. Toward the end of Danielle's love letter to Diddy Kong Racing, how did I never play that? I blame No Mercy. There was a mention of a DS port. It got me thinking, are there any DS/PSP games that rank as hidden gems worth tracking down? Are there ports that hold up and might be the best way to experience classics? As the owner of a dusty 3DS and a dustier Vita, this could be a decent way to lower those dinos into the ground, most likely with a chiptune cover of Chops playing in the background. Anyway, recommendations heartily welcomed. Thanks. Whew, I will tell you this. I sure love the hell out of Meteos and Honey... God, I think it's called Honeycomb Beat. Let me make sure. It's Honeycomb Beat.
I've not even heard of that game.
It's a really obscure Honeycomb Groove? Honeycomb DS. Let's see. It is Honeycomb Beat. Okay. Honeycomb Beat is a really, really good original DS puzzle game. It's a Hudson Soft game, and I'm seeing some poor reviews for it, and I think those people are banana pants, because it was a really good
puzzle game. Wow, hey, that's, you know, we're supposed to be respectful of other people and their opinions, calling them banana pants, Danielle. Doesn't feel very Waypoint. I know Austin's not here.
See, Austin's not here. I can say banana pants all I want.
Damn, savage.
I know, right? Well, You're drinking your Kahlua coffee, so yeah, we're
well,
all...
I think maybe you are. Maybe you are. You're the one saying banana pants.
You're right, actually. Yeah, I think my
How does this honeycomb tipped. Game work? I'm watching a video and I still don't quite get it.
Well, basically, you are sort of navigating these honeycomb patterns, and you're kind of, you're matching... Let's see, I think you're actually trying to create honeycomb patterns within a larger honeycomb... thing. Like, you tap on one honeycomb, it changes things, and you have, like, modifier tiles. It's a little bit hard to explain. I would
recommend
actually
watching.
You're
trying to
watching.
Flip the colors, basically.
Like, yeah, you're flipping the colors to make particular patterns. Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
Which is, you know...
Kind of feels a little Picrossi. Like a,
it is a little bit. It is a little bit, actually.
In the same,
I think,
in the same vein.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a little bit. I think that is a fantastic game worth tracking down. It's probably not easy to track down, but
Where's Picross on Switch?
Loved
Give
it.
Me Picross on Switch.
That has to be coming, right?
I mean, there is a Picross Switch game, but it's not Nintendo's Picross game.
Yeah.
I specifically, I've tried to play flat, normal Picross games, and they just pale in comparison to the 3D shape-based Picross games that Nintendo has done over the DS line. And, they would just port one of those to Switch, I would be psyched.
It's gotta be coming. It's gotta be. They're putting everything on the Switch. Sort of. I have faith in that. The other thing I was gonna say is Meteos, a game I, 100%ed once upon a time on
it
the
did have, It did have an adventure mode, didn't it? In addition to a dual mode. That game probably more than any puzzle game I can even think since, that rode that really tough line of chaos and skill where, especially when you would play versus games against people, you could never get quite a grasp on whether you were winning or losing, and things would switch on a dime in a way that it was just, like, you when you were holding the DS, you felt like you were holding on for dear life as you were trying to survive everything that was happening, and it just made... every round of Meteos, just tremendously satisfying and also surprising, because it never felt like you knew what was going to happen the moment it opened.
Yeah. It was, oh my god, that was, my bedtime game for a long time. I like playing puzzle games in bed. It's a thing that I do, and it was, I would put it on the more chill planets. Each planet in Meteos, whatever, each stage, each level, has a different sort of gravity, which was always kind of cool, and also sort of a different, musical cue. And there were some, chill planets that had slower gravity. I would put it on those, I would play those, and I would just... Oh, my God, it was wonderful. That game is fantastic and worth tracking down. Those are probably my picks for... I know people like Lumines. I didn't have a Vita at the time.
PSP.
PSP at the time. Excuse me. Pardon me.
You are
pardon
no
my
longer,
PSP.
You are, pardon your gamer.
Pardon my unwokeness here with the platform, but did you play a lot of that, Patrick or Rob?
Oh, yeah. I imported a PSP because I was, I saw Ridge Racer on that thing. It was just holy shit, I'm in. And there weren't many games at the launch. Ridge Racer was a really great game, and Lumines was either at launch or very soon after, and... I became obsessed alongside my girlfriend became obsessed with Lumines, and we would just kind of swap the machine back and forth, and it was one of the few times that I got into a high score game. It was not usually my thing, but it was one of those moments where, because I had someone in close proximity all the time that was really into it, we would constantly kind of find ourselves in Lumines matches. And yeah, that's a tremendous game that I think kind of got squeezed in the billion ports that came later, but the base idea of Lumines was a really great puzzle game that probably still... Man, put that game on Switch. It's been long enough. I'll play that game again.
Yeah, there you go. Put it on Switch. That's the answer to most things, I think.
# put it on Switch.
Rob, do you have any handheld gems that you've enjoyed quite a bit?
Not really. The handhelds were never really my thing, right?
Sure.
Being on PC, the handhelds... always were just, they felt wrongly to me, I think, a little too limited. I realize now what a fool I was to sleep on the DS, but there you have it. I think as far as backwards compatibility and everything, that's the other thing, is if you're native to PC, a lot of this stuff just still exists, and so there's not as much pressure or desire for, like, oh, I sure want that to come out on this platform. The exception being, I'm kind of into the idea of more things coming out on Switch. Like, the minute that Darkest Dungeon port hits, buy a PC Darkest Dungeon, because that's a game that sort of lends itself to just sort of, like, twiddling with.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say, as somebody who is actually having a little bit of trouble with her launch 3DS in terms of, I have a wrist injury and it hurts a little bit to play my 3DS for too long, I sure appreciate the Switch for being a little bit more ergonomically correct. And also, yep, it sure is great for games that are fiddly. It works pretty fucking well.
Hey, don't do what I did and lose the kickstand on the back of that thing.
Oh.
I put it up, I don't like the angle that the Switch goes at on a kickstand, generally speaking. Like, I've tried to do the thing where I take off the Joy-Cons on a flight and, like, stand it up, and I actually want it to be at, like, a steeper angle than it's actually capable of doing with the built-in kickstand, but I was giving it a shot when I was on a flight a couple of weeks back, and, it, like, as I was bending it, like, it doesn't stay in very well, and it came off, and it fell down into the black hole that is my bag, my kid's bag, the bags around me. Like, I mean, it couldn't have gone. It did not go far. I knew the general vicinity in which it fell, and I searched through. I was like, "Oh, I'll find it when we get off the flight." Look around. Could not find that kickstand. And so, if the kickstand falls off, and then you hold the Switch again, like, your finger falls, your right hand falls right over where it was. Like, there's no way to, like, grip the Switch and not feel like a dip in the machine, and, like, it goes from the nice plastic feel to, like, the metal underneath. It was terrible. So then I had to spend, like, I couldn't buy one locally, so I had to buy one from Nintendo's website, and it's only, like, $4, but it's $4 plus, like, you know, like, $6. Like, the shipping costs more than the goddamn kickstand. So don't lose that, because it's a pain in the ass to hold the machine afterwards. It's a pain in the ass to buy another one, and that's my rant. I don't have a point. I'm just saying, don't lose your kickstand.
Don't lose your kickstand. I think that's fair. Kickstand. That sounds like losing your.
Don't lose it on a bike either. That's bad. Like, kickstands are cool on bikes. Don't lose it. I don't know how you lose it, but I'm just saying, general rule: don't lose your kickstand.
Yeah, don't lose your kickstand. It sounds like losing your stylus from the DS days, I mean, we're still in the DS days, but oh my god, that fucking thing. Oh. I've lost so many styluses. I usually find them eventually, but, like, that's a problem. Then you just got to use your fingers for everything. That's just not great. It's not great. Last thing I'll say is Hotel Dusk, a game I still need to play, but I've heard nothing but amazing things about it, and I sure love pulpy detective fiction, so I'm just going to throw that on there. Hotel Dusk is one that I need to track down myself.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Oh, there's so many gems. I'm really excited about those gems. Speaking of gems, Patrick, give me a number. Give me a nice number. Let's dig back in to an older bucket.
How high do our numbers go? What's my range?
Let's see. We've got, I think we've got
50.
Yeah, 49 actually, as of right now.
It's 49, like, man. You've been left behind. Come back into the fold.
Oh, you know what's really great is 49 has an SF on it, like San Francisco 49ers. Yeah, it's real nice. All right, ready? Hey, Waypoint team. I'm loving the work you do, especially the podcasts. My political games question is, how have you seen games change through the Bush and Obama administrations? Is there any significant change in theme, stories, etc. between the two? I would have pitched this as a story, but I am a terrible writer.
Welcome to the club, buddy. Don't let that stop you.
Don't let it crush your dreams, Kenny.
You can convince everyone. Don't worry.
Honestly, to answer this question, it's a little tough because games as a medium certainly had a lot of maturing to do during those times. Like, if we're talking Bush and Obama era, we're talking 2000 to last year. So that entire, we're talking like Xbox, actually PS2 era, all the way up until, you know, 2016.
Well, we were all pretty young too, right? I mean, like, that's like one of the things about, you know, we're all like roughly in the same ballpark on age, and like, it's not that I wasn't aware of like the Bush years and like vaguely aware of politics, but like a lot of us sort of like came of age in terms of like real political, like paying attention to what's going on, like in the Obama years. So it's like, even it's hard for me to even think about one. I think games just weren't very, other than being inherently political, right? Like where like your personal politics informs like what you create. Games just weren't really doing a lot of commenting on the outside world in like a very pointed, purposeful way. Like I think it's, games were a lot more, they were still commenting on the culture, but it was like more through osmosis as opposed to like, we're doing this to say something. That was just far rarer back then. And I just wasn't thinking about games or thinking about politics in that way. I don't, maybe you two are different than the folks that I know and how I was, but I wasn't even really thinking about games in that way during that era.
I'm going to guess that we all had our first voting experience in 2004. For presidential vote, is that?
Yep.
Yeah, Carrie. Right? Yeah, that was. Yeah,
for,
yeah.
Yeah, Carrie. I'm pretty sure we all. I'm not gonna say who we all voted for, but like that was the election. It was Bush Carrie. so yeah, I certainly think there is a jingoism to the early Bush years, especially the sort of post 9/11 sort of era in which there. The thing that's hard to do is to separate that from the regular sort of jingoism of the military shooter in general, right? That's kind of been a thing in video games since there have been video games, right? It has always been made by a particular type of person who may have had a particular type of feeling about conflict and violence and that sort of thing.
Especially especially at the advent of, like, Call of Duty, right? Like, I mean, obviously, yes, Call of Duty has changed a lot in the years since.
The cinematic military shooter, I guess, is a way of putting that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's...
Oh, sorry.
That's
I thought you were going to keep going.
No, my own. It's not,
well, I can... Okay, so I can dive in there.
Really making me look like an asshole. I was like,
sorry!
Here's your... Say your great point, Patrick.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure Rob can save me here.
Yeah, because actually I was writing a piece about this last night.
All right, you're playing the new Call of Duty. Right.
Yeah, I am. And this isn't a huge angle in the piece, so I don't feel too bad talking about it here, but like... So Call of Duty and the entire like military shooter genre that sort of crops up in the early 2000s is really a reaction to World War II like nostalgia that was really sort of a peak commodity in the late 90s into the early 2000s. Like Saving Private Ryan kind of like mainstreams this. There's a lot of like 50th anniversary nostalgia. And the Call of Duty games are explicitly like playing on that. And explicitly playing on this idea of like very the Stephen Ambrose vision of the, you know, American GI liberating Europe. And telling that story again and again, basically recreating scenes from famous like TV shows and movies. I think something that changed is that, first of all, the fantasies of warfare changed. Like with modern warfare, you start seeing... Well, modern warfare was easy to believe at the time had more of a position than it turns out ultimately to have had. Like it, what, like there were things that seemed political and critical in that game that I'm not sure were really intended to be that way. Like the AC-130 gunship scene where you're like,
blowing dudes away
from a FLIR cam.
I mean, because that was kind of interpreted at the time as like, oh, this is like commenting on like the distance we have in warfare about how we. You know, just casually kill people. But I think it was more just like, hey, this is a cool scene.
right. And that's an important moment because, like, it read at the time to a lot of people as being deeply unsettling because our vision of war was still kind of in this nostalgic World War II vision of, like, it being personal and dramatic and...
Heroic in a way, I suppose.
Yeah. And modern warfare has the scene... that I think was meant to just be like, hey, this is going to be cool. And people don't react to it like it's going to be cool. They react to it like, this seems a little fucked up. Because this is representing like what is going to increasingly become the American way of war through the 2000s and the teens. Since then, like a couple other things happened. None of our wars fucking ended. like the first game about Afghanistan cropped up in like it was Medal of Honor, and it was like 08, 09.
Yeah.
And at the time it was like, oh boy, is this too soon? Like maybe we should. Well, the war's still going. You can still set things in Afghanistan. And what's interesting with the new Call of Duty is that it's about World War II, but it has this sort of like modern mindset of like these guys seem like they've been at war for fucking ever. Like the characters are talking about this as if they've been fighting the Germans for eternity, or they've been in the army for an eternity. Not, you know, the American campaign, the Allied campaign in Europe after D-Day was like less than a year. Like that's how long it took to wrap things up with that part of the war. But the perspective that sort of shot through the game isn't about World War II. It's about how we feel about our conflicts now and how we envision like war fighting. And so I kind of feel like something that changed is the idea of what war looks like, but also what victory and defeat might look like, what you hoped for from war. Early games were about like, you know, you defeat evil and you go home and you resume your lives as citizens. Now it's kind of this, you know, forever war model. And the characters, no matter what war the game is about, the characters kind of inhabit the space that America psychologically inhabits right now, where nobody ever goes home. You know, the swords are never beaten into plowshares. It just drags on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very wise. I looked up a piece that we actually published last June by Seth Shepard, who goes into this. The piece is largely about Vanquish, but it sort of starts out with a thesis about the aesthetics of the sort of cinematic modern military shooter and how it did actually change sort of post 9/11. So I'm just going to read a little bit of it. I can put a link in the show notes, but this seemed relevant to this question, so I'll just read this a little bit. Post 9/11, news outlets looped images of the war on terror and a traumatic environment materialized, in which these accelerating images proliferated across screens, networks, and space. The effect of this war coverage was seen in pop culture with the prominence of impact aesthetics, an intensified style meant to elicit a physical response from the viewer. It existed before the war on terror, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'll go to the next graph here. However, as the war was fought and its imagery normalized, these aesthetics were applied to stories about terror and counterterror, sleeper cells, and state data collection. In TV series like 24, films like the Bourne series franchise, and Eagle Eye, the style permeated commercial images, even showed up in the fashion world as clothing brands like Tap Out and Affliction became popular for their abrasive and pre-distressed designs. All of these cultural products competed for consumer attention across multiple screens by leveraging these aesthetics as a shorthand to communicate that they were more real or at least more immediate than the others. In these cultural aesthetics imprinted upon the game developer and upon game developer simulations of reality, creating the gritty military shooter. So his whole thesis is that, yeah, this is part of a larger movement, especially in that sort of general post 9/11 era. You know, that I guess like later Bush era, even obviously 9/11 was early Bush era, but as things developed, as games, you know, obviously AAA games take a little while to develop, these things sort of permeated. So I think there's some value in that as well, as of course what you're saying, Rob, about the sort of forever war mentality that is in everything right now, that sort of comments on war in any meaningful way. So yeah, I'm going to take another question from the newer bucket, and it might not be quite as heavy as the one that we just did, but there's a story here, and I do like a good story. So here we go. Actually, this is a complete coincidence, but I think this is actually from Seth Shepard, who wrote that piece, and I really didn't mean to do this. But, but like, literally, this letter is from Seth Shepard, who wrote that piece for us, and it was just, this happened to be what it was. So here's a story from Seth. Hey, Waypoint team. Your discussion of Chill Out Man in episode 113 made me remember a favorite streamer of mine that I found with some friends named DJFL3XXO. Have you ever used the PS4's Live from PlayStation app? If not, it's a beautiful app that comes pre-installed on your PS4. It collects all of the live streams that are broadcast to the PS4, and you can search by game. So sometimes college buds and I would pass time with this app and searching for all streams of the game The Playroom, another pre-installed app that uses the camera and makes augmented reality games of the player's space. This is essentially the Twitch IRL section of Live from PlayStation, because the player can just broadcast their image and do whatever they want, And a lot of the times it means teens are racist, sometimes both, sitting with a beer or some weed and responding to the few but dedicated viewer comments. One time we were waiting for a friend to drive over and I was showing my friend this wondrous app. We tuned into a stream by DJ FL3XXO and found a masked man chain-smoking and giving a complete professional electro house DJ set to an empty living room, complete with speaker towers, a full DJ console, a smoke machine, and synchronized lights. He's lost in the mix, dancing and motioning to the camera. He was streaming through YouTube, so I instantly subscribed. And Seth was kind enough to give us the channel link. From what I've been able to find about the masked DJ, he's 28 and from Melbourne, Australia. He self-describes as Dirty Dutch and Melbourne Bounce Banger. And his channel over 20 DJ streams that run from 2 to 3.5 hours. As far as other streams on the app, once we saw some skate shop employees got really paranoid that we would dox them for smoking weed on camera, some very bad parties, and a kid streaming his subscriber count as he got closer to 50. So my friends and I subscribed to push the kid over the edge.
Oh, that's very good. Oh, this is the story over?
Apparently it did.
So this reminds me of when Periscope launched, and I'd gotten the new Apple TV, which has apps on it, and so. My friends and I, kind of like at the end of the night, like people are like, you know, finishing their drink before they're going home. And we would load up the Periscope app on the Apple TV so we could all watch it on the big screen. And I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast how like, when we were talking about Chill Out Man, it was like, I'm a huge fan of like finding people exactly like this DJ. Folks that are just streaming to like nobody or like the three people they've got or like they're really excited. Like they're just, hey man, you work with what you got. And so... I can't remember how this happened. It started with looking up people that had low viewer counts. And then we started noticing this pattern of people streaming out of their garage. Like, it was just a thing we just kind of noticed. It was, like, a bunch of people with, like, 2 or 3 viewers or, like, no viewers streaming out of their garage. And so then we made it a point to try and find people specifically that were streaming out of their garage. Periscope doesn't, like, search by... There's no way to search for people in garages. There's no, like, tick in the background for that. And then we would go in there, and we would ask them questions about their garage, sincerely. Like sincere questions about their garage. Like, hey, did you recently have that wall painted? We would do, it was called hashtag garage life. And it would be, like, 3 of us all in the chat. And, like, the 3 of us in there would, like, instantly double, like, you know, the viewer count. And often the people in their garage happened to be vaping or smoking other substances, and they would get very paranoid that we were sincerely asking questions about their garage. Like, did you recently put in an expansion? Like, I've been thinking about expanding my garage. Like, how did you negotiate the contract and, like, figure out, like, the design of the garage? Like, just, like, very specific questions. And I don't know why it was so funny, but I think because it was so, like, banal and strange, yeah. And because it was such a small viewer count, it often made the people incredibly paranoid in a way that usually got us blocked and banned very quickly. But I we did that for a little while before the joke kind of ran itself into the ground. But it was a very enjoyable moment. It was like trolling without trolling. It was mostly just like by being like perfectly normal but incredibly specific. People just they were not having it. So hashtag garage life.
Garage life. I really think some of the weirder, you know, obviously when I'm saying weirder, I mean in this way weird, not like harmful weird, but like, you know, just very specific or very normal or very like impassioned things that happen on streams are one of my favorite things about living in this very bizarre era. Just the things that sort of cross that public and private space line, but in a not harmful way. Like, I, of course, obviously in this world, we also have to say that the like not harmful way, like these completely sort of like okay interactions that we can have that are just weird. There's something about that that is like really funny and pleasant. Like the whole time you were telling that story, I was like delighted. I was like, I wonder what was in his garage. Like,
right.
Tell me the story of the, you know, ancient power wheels that only has one wheel or something that's hanging out in your garage. Like, I just sort of love whatever it is about that that makes it so funny and delightful.
Okay, this is real random.
Yeah.
Good.
Was there a garage hangout culture where you grew up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, a lot of my I think we only had one friend that had a, like, a basement, and, like, another friend that had a basement. Like, it was, like, off limits to us, like, it, for whatever reason. So, like, the garage became, like, a place where, like, a lot of people could hang out and not, like, interfere with your parents.
Kids, like,
yeah. Teens. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So, what I'm talking about is something a little, like, I've only, like, been in one place where this was a thing. So, around, what was it, Hurricane Ike, my parents were flooded out of their house, which was a pretty significant personal catastrophe. But, long story short, my parents ended up having to basically live away from their neighborhood for about a year. While while the flood is being dealt with, which, by the way, an important thing is, because this has been a terrible year with hurricanes and everything, like, stuff drops from the headlines way before the personal, like, trauma and crisis, like, ends.
Yeah.
Like, if your house is destroyed by a flood, like, your life becomes about waiting for basic shit, like the contractor to show up who can pump out your fucking basement. Like, there aren't that many people who have those tools. So it takes a while for them to show up. Anyway, so my family's, like, living away from our neighborhood for a while. And they end up in this neighborhood in, like, still northwest Indiana, but just a different part of it. And there is this weird, like, everyone in this neighborhood, on any kind of nice day, like, around dinner time or thereafter, would go and, like, open up their garage door. And hang out in their garages. But, like, not in their garages, but, like, right, like, on the lip of the, like, you know, under the eaves, basically. And, like, face out into the neighborhood. And it was the weirdest damn thing. Like, nobody parked their cars in the garage. Everyone had attached garages. But, like, you'd, like, 7 at night, you'd, like, look out. And all your neighbors would be in these weirdly, like, nicely furnished garages. Just sitting there. Staring into each other's garages and, like, hanging out on, like, couches and, like, lazy boys and sectionals. And, like, that was just what people did. And it's not like they interacted. It's not like people were like, hey, Frank, how's it going? No, they would just sit in their garage and, like, spend time there. And it was, there was clearly, like, my parents, like, noticed there was clearly, like, competition about, like, pimping out your garage.
Wow.
Like, people put effort into, like, really making, like, it's because it's literally, like, you know, you sort of open the curtain on your garage and it's like, hey, check this out, and it's like leather sectional, right? Or like a big screen, like, TV in the garage behind the couch that nobody is facing. It's just there to be seen. It was the weirdest fucking thing I've ever, like. And so I was like, is this a thing? Is this, like, is there, like, a suburban culture in America that I'm just not familiar with and, like, briefly got a glimpse of it? Or did my parents just end up in, like, the freaking Twilight Zone?
I'm going to be honest. The kinds of people whose garages I was looking at did not seem like the kinds of... They were not necessarily the people that were really spending a lot of time pimping out their garage with...
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't let kids, like, play music and smoke weed in these garages.
How no, like... no, no, no.
Wow.
That's very good. Wow, a lot of garage stories.
That's amazing.
Hashtag garage life.
My only contribution to this at all is that summers, we would, whenever there were, like, parties, I have, like, a massive family. We have, like, 10 billion relatives. Like, half of Rhode Island I'm related to. And, like, we would have, like, lots of parties that involved a garage, but, like, it was a hanging out thing. It was, like, a social thing. Like, you know, the adults would have beer and the kids would have ice cream or whatever, and we would all be, like, running around playing basketball, and the adults were sitting there in the garage. That was, like, that was it. But, man, that Twilight Zone garage life, that's something else, man. I, like, it's kind of amazing. Do you think it has anything to do with, like, I don't know, if the garage is visible, that's, like, the part of the house that you want to look nice because your neighbor Frank is like, judging your sofa or something? Or is it, like...
I mean, I do one thing in my neighborhood, I'll walk around and there are, like, certain neighbors that just keep their garage open as, like, a signal that, like, hey, if you want to come, like, say hi, like, they'll have, like, TVs in their garage
nice.
And stuff like that. So it's not they're not, like, particularly fancied up, but it is sort of like a signal of, like, hey, if, like, the Cubs game is on, you want to come have a beer, like, the garage is open.
That's the garage nice. Is open. Yeah. That's really nice. Yeah.
I mean, the suburbs are full of weird, like, look, it's not a great movie in a lot of ways, but the Tom Hanks comedy classic, Burbs.
Hell yeah, Burbs.
Yeah.
A decent representation of the sheer weirdness of living in suburbs. There were, like, we would get, okay, I don't even know what you call this. You have a driveway, and your driveway, like, it's rare that driveways are just a single piece of, like, asphalt. Like, a lot of times the driveway is, like, concrete slabs, right?
Yeah.
And in the cracks of those slabs or in the seams between those slabs, like, occasionally, like, weeds grow up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shit happens. We had a couple neighbors who, like, when our driveway was kept somewhat disorderly, they felt. When there were a few too many green shoots cropping up between those slabs, they would come over and just like sort of chat up my dad and then work the conversation around to what they were really there about.
Mm.
Which is like, so, you know, just couldn't help but notice that, need a little edging work to be done here, don't you? Your edge are broken? I can lend you mine.
Wow.
This shit happens, and it's all real, and people, like, comment on it and judge each other on it. The greatest, like, justice we ever got, by the way, was the neighbor who always, like, criticized the state of our lawn because my dad didn't give a shit, so, like, leaves would pile up on it, and, like, he just didn't care that much. And we had a neighbor who, like, religiously, like, mowed that thing, like, with a ruler, basically. Just, like, it looked like a fairway. Like, everything kept, like, perfectly level. The lines were glorious. Always mowed it the same way. They were so, like, maniacal about having the best lawn that they just went, like, buck wild with fertilizer at some point. And you ever heard of, like, fertilizer burn?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that stuff can be really toxic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they basically blighted their lawn for like 6 years. Like, their beautiful, glorious lawn. They put like this giant, like enormous football-shaped fertilizer burn on it that like nothing would grow on for like 6 years. It took a long time for it to go away. I think they might have had to resod it eventually. But it was justice because like they constantly came over to be like, letting a lot of leaves pile up, Bob.
Aww.
Can't help it. You need to borrow my blower? Like, shit like that. And so naturally, they, like, devastated their lawn. And it was glorious. Like, you know, ours was, like, beautiful, lush, wild. Yes, untamed. The grass was going to seed. But at the same time, we didn't have, like, this clear toxic blight. Like the mark of Cain on our lawn.
There was a moment where this is a number of years ago where it's depending on your house and like how much of like the surrounding area that you own, like you may have like bushes that technically you both own because like the greenery straddles both, and then it gets weird. But anyway, so that the bushes in the back of my parents' old house, my parents owned, and the people on the other side of it had asked, "Hey, like we were hoping to maybe like lower them because they were doing some other house stuff." And my mom was like, "Oh, you know, I'll talk to my husband about it." And they ultimately decided that they liked it the way it was, and that the neighbors would just kind of have to deal with it because it was on our property. And one day, my mom woke up and they had just gone and done it. They had just like fucking flattened these bushes, like had severely brought them down. Didn't ask permission, just went for it. My mom was like super upset, less because of how the bushes looked. She didn't actually care that much about it. It was more the audacity just to do it after they'd had a conversation about it. And she was just so aggravated for weeks. And then one time I was over there, and she was like, "Hey, can you help me go take care of this dead animal in the back?" There was like a rabbit that had died.
Aww.
And so I went to go like, you know, grab it and, you know, put it into a like a plastic bag and dispose of it. And I remember remarking to her, like, you know, I could kind of throw it into their lawn in a weird place where this would just rot for weeks before they would know
where
it was. And she, because my mom, like, so mild mannered, like, you know, I'm like, I'm just joking. It's like, because that'd be like a dick thing to do. And she's like, fuck them, throw it over there. And I was like, oh, all right, mom, I'm in. God. Did the whole, like, whipped it up, like, you know, like, whoop, 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 whoop. And I threw it over, like, the corner of an area where, like, the smell would clearly spread, but it would take a long time for them to, like, kind of figure out what was going on. And so, I don't know. We never heard about it because how would they ever pin that back on us? But I know. I know.
Wow.
Thanks, Mom.
Wow. Your mom's awesome.
Somehow this is going to catch up with you.
Yeah. One day.
Of this podcast, like, it's gonna work its way around, like, people who used to, like, know you and your family, and, like, eventually someone's gonna listen to it, and, like, that little son of a bitch.
My dog died because it ate that dead rabbit.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Look, it's, we make choices in life, okay? We make choices.
It's like suburban warfare over here.
Dude,
this is really...
Here's my guess. If we were to ask other people for weird suburban stories, we get a lot of stories like that. Shit goes down. There's a mentality in the suburbs. You're stuck. You don't get to choose your neighbors. You know, like, you hopefully pick a nice neighborhood and with good people, but neighborhoods are often, they choose you. You don't choose them.
It's like they're not quite roommates, but they're people you have to live in close proximity with.
Yep.
Who don't have to consider your feelings at all.
Mm-mm. That's
the weird
part.
You just have to
watch
them living their stupid lives in ways you disapprove of.
Yeah, people are always, like, people from back home, when I go to Rhode Island, and it's not like a, Rhode Island's a weird place. It's basically pretty suburban. There's some small cities. It's like small cities, right? Small cities and some somewhat rural areas. It's so tiny, though, that it all feels like a small town. I'll talk about doing EMS, like being on an ambulance here in Brooklyn and Queens, and they're like, oh my God, you go into strangers' houses in Brooklyn and Queens, and I'm like, please. Like, the suburbs scare me so much more than anything I've seen here. Like, it's really, God, it's just so weird. It's really, hashtag garage life, I guess.
Hashtag garage life. I don't know if we can top that. I think we gotta end this podcast on this suburban note.
Yeah, I think that was beautiful and brilliant. And if you have questions or really good suburban stories,
please, not fuck the questions.
Send them in.
Suburban stories. We'll do a whole pod about the suburbs.
Give us those good burbles, I guess. Send those into gaming@vice.com with the subject question. And if you want to throw burbs in there, I guess that's fine, too. As always, shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We are on Facebook, Waypoint Vice. We are on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And things are actually going up there, thanks to Natalie, who started again about a month ago, which is pretty great. Obviously, you can read all our stuff at waypoint.vice.com. We encourage you to do so, because reading our articles really does help us out quite a bit. So, you can always find me at Danielle R.I. on Twitter. Where can people find you, Patrick?
In the suburbs.
Hashtag garage life.
Yeah, hashtag garage life.
You turn on the floods. Patrick is there, like, with just dead rodents, like, stand dropping them like Santa in people's trash bins.
Don't touch my hedges, motherfucker.
Oh, God. Well, I'm glad we can find you there. Where can we find you, Rob?
Wherever the hell I want to be, because the property line is where I say it is.
Oh, shit. All right, well, I'll keep that in mind. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for listening to Waypoint Radio. I'm going to say the thing I always say, which is be good and be good at it.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.